It's just a few days out from the season four finale of SailGP, with the showdown set to take place in San Francisco on 13th and 14th of July. So, in a break with the usual format for our Road to Gold Q&A live calls, we'll be looking at the unique challenges of SailGP with someone who has been closely involved with that world, Jacopo Plazzi. But before we introduce Jacopo, I also want to mention that we will be speaking to Simone Selva, coach to the Spanish team, who's also been working closely with Hamish Wilcox, who's also working closely with the Spanish team. So, Hamish, you've got a busy few weeks coming up because your boys, Diego Botin and Florian Trittel, you're going to be with them at the Olympic Games later on this month. And then, of course, you're working with them in SailGP as well. So tell us, how does that work?
Well, yeah, it's really hectic right now. It's also, a massive amount of fun. And it's such a privilege to be involved at this level with this caliber of sailors. And, I know I'm going to feel a lot better about when things are finished, in terms of SailGP, tick, Olympics, tick. And then, it'll be nice to focus on just one thing. But yeah, no, it's been a real pleasure, this journey I've had with both, SailGP Spain and 49er Olympics Flo and Diego.
Great. And Jacopo, welcome onto the show. Thanks so much for joining us. You've got a background in 49ers. You've hit the podium in the 49er, and you've got a fantastic career at the top of the sport right now. Just tell us what's been your involvement with SailGP.
Yeah, thanks for having me in Road to Gold. Thanks, Hamish and Andy. And I've been a big follower of the program since the beginning, so it's nice to be here. I started SailGP, a little bit of involvement during season two with Nathan and the Japanese team, when also Keiko Bruni was on board. They took me to a race and coaching. It was very nice. And then I started with when the Swiss team started their journey in SailGP. I started with them. I coached in season three and a bit of season four, and then lately been a bit busy capside, so I had to dedicate myself here. But it's looking forward to be back in SailGP as soon as possible.
And could we just say a quick hello to Simone as well, and just see who's the other guy in the room? Simone Selva, welcome and thanks for joining us. And I see you're wearing the Spanish shirt of SailGP. So tell us, what are you doing with them, and how are things looking for this weekend in San Fran?
Hi, thank you for having me too, and thank you, Hamish. I'm off to for San Francisco in a couple of days, and everything looks quite set up, and let's hope to get some good wind, and I think the guys are quite on point so far, so we are there.
Excellent, excellent. Well, Jacopo, as I mentioned at the top of the show, one of the most amazing things about SailGP is the amount of data that we're allowed to see, and that presumably has been a big part of what you've done with the teams that you've worked with. So, just tell us, what was it like getting into that world of data? You must have been like a kid in a candy store.
Yeah, absolutely. So the program we usually work with, they don't have this access to basically everything, every data of each boat. So you get access to all the best teams, and you can really dig into the data and understand how they do things, how the teams like approaching similar program problems and how they solve them. And you have access to this Oracle Cloud, which basically is where all the data is stored after each day of sailing. And you can well get lost into it, but after a bit you understand which is the important bit of data to look at, and you can really use it to make the best for your team and push their development.
Well, I just want to remind viewers that this is an interactive call if you want it to be. So this is your opportunity to speak to these three fantastic sailors and coaches, to ask what you want to know about SailGP and if there is anything that relates to the world that you're racing in. And I noticed, for example, that Matheus Kuzmerovic is on the call, Olympic gold medalist in the Finn in 1996. And talking about data, there's one single bit of data that we all use. And hi, Matheus. Let's get you in, because you managed to win that gold medal without an important piece of data, which was you lost your wristwatch, and then you had to run off the time on the race committee boat. But am I right? Let's get you in, Matheus, and see if that's correct.
Such a great memory, Andy.
Because it's such a crazy story. So tell us.
I know. And it comes together that I'm working with the Omega now as my new partner here in Poland. Yeah, actually, when you lost something, you're looking for some other opportunities. So this is how it came through. When I lost it just 10 minutes before the gun, you know, on the stadium, they have a big screens, Omega, the supplied. And I found out that on the race committee, we've got the same. So it opened my eye. And actually, I could look also not inside my boat, but also outside. Yeah, it came together well.
Amazing. Well, I don't know how closely you've been following SailGP, but what interests you most about what you've seen of SailGP, and especially in relation to all the data that comes out of it?
Right. So I'm watching every race. America's Cup, SailGP, TP52. This is how I learn from other people. And actually, I'm not following data so much, but I'm following how the team's communicating. It was great in Oakland, America's Cup. You could watch one time the race from, you know, one perspective, so how the broadcasts went. But you could also watch the same race another time, watching from the onboard camera. So I learned how Team New Zealand, how Ineos and the other teams and Prada Pirelli, how they communicated, how they trim, how they made the tactics, how what they look at. And actually, I brought it for my sailing. I sailed 5.5 star Cape 31 now. So actually, for me, it's an opportunity to learn from others. And I'm really interested to what I'm going to hear today from you guys, because I didn't follow the data, which, Andy, you are asking the guys. So, looking forward for that.
Well, Matheus, it's great to have you on the call. And if you do have any specific questions that crop up during the call, then please do use the chat box and we'll get you back in again. Before we get back to Jacopo, let's just ask Martin Langhoff if we can get him in to ask a question about the wing inversion button. So let's see if you're there, Martin.
Yeah. Hi, everyone. Great seeing you. Great meeting you all. Yeah, so we all saw Team USA capsize two events back, a friend of mine, Victor Diaz de Leon, was wing trimmer. He took responsibility for it. It seemed like it landed a bit hard on him, not just the capsize itself, but the whole event and the whole incident. And but now we saw Australia having wing inversion issues and blaming it on an electronic gremlin. I'm sure it's impossible to know now, but you know, what's further than the docks?
Yeah, I think that's a good one. Basically, when you go back and watch the data of these things, you will see the actuation of the button. So that's a digital input for the inverter button, which is just a button on a keyboard that a few guys on board have, but usually it's the in that case could be either one of the grinders or the wing trimmer inverting the wing, or could be also the flight controller, depending on the playbook of the different teams. You got a bunch of position on board where you have this button, and generally most of the teams, it's usually about the in the maneuver, it's about the grind, inverting the wing. But the, you know, the wing trimmers, they have it. They usually use it when they sail four people on board, three people on board. That's their role. And it's very close to other settings of the wing. So what happened possibly happen with Americans was that probably Victor wanted to play with the camber of the wing, and by mistake he went on the wrong button and inverted the wing. And what the inverter does, basically we're talking about a big solid that was 24 meter configuration wing, and the inverter mirrors the camber of the wing on the other side and flips the twist all the way to the other side. So if you invert on a reaching, you're going to increase massively your healing moment, and that basically creates the capsize. And the same, you know, on the upwind, what happened to Australians is pretty much the same. But again, it's impossible to prove if it was a electronical failure or accidental press. But I mean, the guys have so much experience on the Australian team that I think we can trust them when they say it. But yeah, you know, two different situations, so little time, and the outcome is pretty much the same. Less, you know, when you do it upwind, it's less sudden. You have time to hold on in your seats. On a reach, could be. I mean, we've seen how it evolved. But yeah, it's good and bad of technology. You know, you get you get to be very accurate with what you're doing, and you have to deal with the maintenance and the use of all of these tech and electronics on board that in the end is the only way to control a such perfect machine, you know, and performant machine as well.
Yeah, so I'm a computer geek, and I'll say don't trust the computer for this.
Martin, what would be your answer? If you don't trust the computer, who do you trust? Do you trust the should it be a piece of rope?
Oh, you know, I foil on boats where all the mechanics of foiling are mechanics, right? And so a lot of people want to put controllers on them, like replace the moth wand with something electronic and sensors, and all the sensors get confused with the shine of the sun on the water, and then the actuator runs out of battery, or the servo gets wet and gets stuck. It's just all bad news. So as much as I like computers, and you could make all these dampening things, you could make all these pretty things, yeah, simply it's better. But obviously it doesn't scale to something of the size of these catamarans. But that's my answer on smaller boats, right? But yeah, and otherwise, yeah, it's impossible to know, right? If the computers glitch, I think Tom said, let's have a program where we replace all the electronics, just even if they haven't failed, they just rotate them or replace them. And that's probably a pretty good idea, because, you know, salt water will get to you.
Martin, great question and great insights. And please do come back in later if you've got any other questions or observations. So, guys, let's dig into the data analysis that you've done of season three. So this is last year. Jacopo, just tell us the scenario of who you were working with and what you were trying to achieve at the time.
Yeah, as I said, I've been involved with the Swiss team for the season. That was their first season. And at the end of it, we were trying to figure out a bit what the best teams did and through season three, and where were the basically crunch points? How did you get to that final? No, I think it was interesting speaking earlier this week with Hamish. We were thinking, yeah, you have to win the final when you're in the three boats final, and that's one thing. But before doing that, you have to be there after more than last year was 11 events, this year would be 13 events, and you know, CGP is growing and growing. So I wanted to start from there, you know, like answering the question, how did those teams, how did New Zealand, GBR and Australia got to that final? And then we can have a look in San Fran and how things evolved in the final race. So I'm going to share my screen for this, Sam.
Season three stats, we see it.
Yeah, nice. So basically, what I did here is basically collected the races from last season, and this is just about the qualifying races. So every event in SailGP, you kind of have five races of qualifying, and then there's the final race between the last three teams, between the top three teams of that quali series. I just got the quali races here, so it's five races of each event that you need to get in each single final, and basically the ranking is pretty much the same of what you get if you include all the final races. So this for me was the most important thing. You know, sailing is even a sport of consistency, and SailGP is sailing. So you can see well here that there were a little difference in how the teams ranked at the end of the year, but because I think Australians won the season before getting into the final. But actually, if you watch at this little box here, you can already see that the Kiwis actually pretty much on the same average points won the season in the qualifying races. Australia was second and GBR was third. So the three teams that actually got into the final were the ones at the top also of the qualifying series. And going down from there also France, which I think finished fourth in the last season, was fourth. So yeah, strict correlation there. Basically, we got 50 races in qualifying races in season three, 11 events. And these were the three top teams. And the basically, to access the final of each event, you had to score an average of 4 points. And this was with 10 boats on the line. No, 9 boats on the line, sorry. This year, I was talking with Andy before, we didn't do the stats yet. But it won't change. I expect it not to change massively, like even with one more boat more in the list there. What is quite interesting is how the distribution of results per race ended up in season three. You can really see how the Australians, the Kiwis, they really like to win races, and another guy that you know likes to push it and be at the front, especially in the starts, is it's Phil, so the Canadian. So we see that typically this three teams and GBR as well, they were the ones with more race wins. And then you can see the distribution for Australia is really impressive. Like during last season, they were most of the time finishing in top four, like very little out of there. And while, you know, like GBR consistency, it's again, very good. The Kiwis had a bit more up and downs, but again, they were the team that was most able to win races last year. So this is how it played there. And moving forward, I think something that in SailGP you really have to be good at if you want to win races and be in that final at the end of the season is being a good starter. The starts, these reaching starts of SailGP are so critical, and they're so much key to the success of the team, and the team spend a huge amount of time reviewing the tactics, the all the positioning in the box before the start, and basically how to get the best outcome at mark one. Mark one is the first reaching mark, and this for me is one of the key points we can get an answer from. And if you watch last year, the first four teams at that mark were basically Canada. As I said, Phil is a very strong starter. Australia, second. GBR, third. Then we had France, fourth. And New Zealand, fifth. And the interesting thing is here, the Kiwis did really well from being fifth as an average at Mark 1 last year to climbing their way to the top of the leaderboard. So we'll see it in a minute there. So basically, the other two teams that we got in the top three are GBR and Australia, and they are also on the podium of the season. So this shows how a direct correlation you get with starts. And yeah, so basically this is another little stats I did is who did most winning stats. So Canada 11 times, first at Marquand, Australia 10 times, New Zealand 8 times. And this, I think, is quite important because it shows that Australians had a lot of moments that, where they won a start, with first at Marquand. And when you get to a final race where you're just three boats, getting in front of that first mark is even more critical, no? So this could be, you know, it's a funny one, but could be a little hint, you know, like the ability or really winning starts is probably something that gives an advantage in a final race. And yeah, then I like to, this is a very old thing that got from Valentin Mankin in the Olympic classes. He'd like to divide the line in three zones. So you've got zone one, which is the committee end of the line. The middle of the line is zone two, and zone three is the pin. And we really see the top four at Mark One. They usually come from the pin, or so that's 44% of the time. The top four at Mark One are coming from the pin end of the line, and not a big amount of that is coming from the middle of the line. So we'll go in a bit of styles of starting later, but basically how this reaching starts usually it's placed is that the race management likes to favor a little bit the pin. So you get a bit of the aggressive moves to win that pin. And we always saw it also in the last races. We saw Spain winning a race starting in the pin, the final race. We saw UBR, right, doing the same. So, you know, winning that pin, it's probably not a big one. We can have a look at. And, yeah, so this is about the start. And every team has its own style. There's not one that works in particular, you know, like similar outcomes coming from completely different starts. But here, this is quite funny, but this is last season. So season three, you know, the Australians really like to start in the middle of the line, while GBR love the pin, which is the gray slice of cake here. The Canadians are pretty much even in the zone. But yeah, for me, there are two ways you win and start in CGP. One is speed differential at gun. So really making sure that you're going faster than all the other boats when you hit the gun. Obviously, you've got to be at gun crossing the line. But getting that extra speed comes from far away. You know, you have to position in a way that you actually come back with less time to kill to the line. And this is something that the Canadians I really, really feel is really, really good at doing. I'm impressed on Diego this year with the Spanish, like managing his time to kill and coming from behind real fast. That's a great ability he has. And the French, they developed so well the technique. Nathan is another one. Anyways, that's one way. So basically creating that speed differential and managing well your time to kill. The other one, as we saw before, is really relying on the shorter course that you can sail, and generally it is coming from the pin. You got an information on your software that they got on the wing that is indicating you the fast point, but generally it's about where the pin is. And you saw Ben really like that theory of starting in the pin through the season, and that paid off quite well. Yeah, I'm going to talk a little bit. If you guys have questions, I'm happy to stop before going forwards.
Well, I'd like to know from Simone and or Hamish how the Spanish sort of your reaction to looking at those pie charts and what you would change, if anything, based on the Spanish pie chart compared with any of the others.
Season three.
There you go.
Yeah, basically, I think what Jacopo just said, I think is matching perfectly also what is happening in this season. Most of the time, let's say the pin is quite favored because of the geometry between the starting line and mark one. So, for example, we did really good start starting from the pin in Bermuda with, let's say, the last start positioning quite high in the box. and then bending away down until the pin with, as he said, a big speed differential. So I'm not surprised about, let's say, this outcome of season three is matching, honestly, almost perfectly also this season. As I said, I think speed differential, I would say, is probably the topic number one. And the French, as Jacopo said, are the masters on that. If you see them start all the race, they are starting really, really high in the box and bearing away behind all the fleet. And even starting like 1 second late, maybe sometimes, let's say second row, with the speed differential, especially when we are sailing with HSB, so with small boards, that the speed differential is more normally because you are not saturating the speed as with the LABs. They are normally really good to find the gap and overtake, let's say, and be consistent in these starts. Maybe not winning every start, but let's say the goal is get an average of, like, I don't know, fourth, fifth position at Mark One and then play the rest of the race, obviously.
And how do you practice this stuff? You could obviously talk it through and you've got access to simulators as well, but when practice time is so limited, how do you actually work out a way of executing this as effectively as possible?
That's a good point.
Yeah.
For you. I think the limited amount of time in SailGP it's a big one, as in a lot of other sailing programs, but in SailGP is particularly big, and that's why SailGP is now it's working a lot on simulations and providing the sailors the tools also to work out of the water on it. Plus, we try to run through all the starts between events and understand really where to be placed in different situations to get the outcome you want to get. Like Simone was mentioning, one of the styles that is really paying off this season and came, I think the French were quite aggressive introducing it at the end of last season, was basically you got this box. We call it the box. The box is basically the area that is digitally delimited behind the line. So usually all the teams will reach into the box on port tech, tech or jibe at the bottom of the box and come back reaching to the line. Something that is really paying off is being able to position in fresh air at the end of the box, having boats in front of you with a bigger time to kill to the line compared to you. So they have to be slower in order to kill time before getting to the gun, while you earn a smaller number of time to kill. So you kind of have to burn less time before the gun. And in this way, you can kind of look for transoms, put your bow down, and get to the line with a lot more speed than the boats are trying to slow down in order to start not over the line. So this is one of the styles we also kind of saw in the final race of last year. So later we're gonna have a look at that. In order to practice that, I think you kind of usually have a day, say GP, a rehearsal day, where you kind of come in with ideas and you practice all the starts you think they're winning starts and then it's about the weekend. So a lot of work offline, a lot of simulation, and then you try to execute it during the race days.
We've got about 30 minutes of the call remaining, and I know that we want to do some analysis of the video of the final race. So I'll let you make the call, Jacopo, as to when we break away from this. But let's take a look at some of your other stats.
So let me get back here. You see it?
We do,
Yeah, so I'm almost done here, but the cool thing, if you watch it last season and you get Mark One as your, let's say, starting point, and then you take it to the finish, those are the ones that I call the points that you gain on the course. And if you see it, the Kiwis last year had a huge number of points gained on the course, 68 points through the season. and you can see the three top scores, top gains on the course are exactly the team that won, that were on the podium of the season. And so Australia, GBR and New Zealand. Obviously, New Zealand has a bigger gain because, as we saw before, they didn't start so well last season. But they were very good on the course. And this is a very good indication because you really see that, you know, 68 points, 43 for GBR, 38 for Australia, and then it's like three USA. So there's a big gap, no? You can really see that the Swiss at their first season, they were struggling on the course, no? So and same Spain, no, like they, I think if you watch the season this season, they would probably, this would be all the way flipped for the Spanish team. But this really gives an indication of the handling level of these teams, and something I think it's really true is that SageP is a really race of boat handling, first of all. And the thing that is happening season by season is that the boat handling of the teams is getting higher and higher, the level. And so all of this is becoming harder to see difference between the teams. But these three teams last year had a big advantage in boat handling. And this is what took them to the, you know, good starting plus good handling on the course, good, you know, positioning, tactical decision. And this is what basically took them to the final. And here you really see all the gains on the course. There's really three teams that are doing it, and that's a big indication where you have to get. No, you got to gain from your starting position to the end of the line if you want to be at the top of the list at the end of the season. And yeah, last little bit of information here. 80% of these gains in season three came from the first lap. So first downwind, first upwind, you know, we SageP, you start reaching, then you bear away, you go to the downwind gate and then back to the upwind. And then depending on the venue, you do a certain amount of laps. The first lap is the key. So you got to be quick in getting back in the game if you don't start so well. So yeah, this was a bit of a overview on how the top three teams got at the final race of the season. And I'll stop my sharing here and we can go into the final race.
Just before we do that, Jacopo, doing all that analysis is absolutely fantastic. It must have also given you a very big shopping list for you to work with the Swiss team. So with limited time, how did you prioritize what the most important tasks were from the where the gaps, the most important gaps to be filled?
Yeah. So with the Swiss team, it's fair to say that last year, the team vision was to basically get a full Swiss team on board the boat. So we started with a sailors lineup, and then towards the end of the season, the Swiss guys started coming on board. And at the beginning of the season, season four, they also got the flight controller for the Swiss guy, a young guy that's also in the cup with Alinghi. And so basically that has been a project that you had to prioritize the growth of new people in SageP. So obviously if you want to cut the corners and you see it, you got class experts. You see the new teams now coming in, and always, you know, Spanish did a great job in integrating a few new people in the game. And basically, with the Swiss, we had at the end of season three to restart a few processes there, so we couldn't really go through everything we analyzed and get it to the next step for the beginning of the season. But yeah, I agree. That's a big shopping list, and usually you kind of isolate this. Basically, this stats gives you a bit the big picture, and then you kind of isolate a few topics in each area and for each person. For the helm, it's going to be particularly getting better at the starts. Then you got the wing trimmer, the you have the proper data from the Oracle Cloud on wing trimming for the different configuration, and you can really watch with the best wing trimmers in the game to get better at. So then basically once you got the big picture clear, you go in real detail for each people on board, and then you try to make them work as a team and take the right decisions. As the previous comment of Mateus, I think, was communication. It's all about communication in CGP. You know, again, it's such a big amount of hours you spend in analyzing that and see how different teams communicate. And Hamish is a master there now. So the Spanish did a good jump there, no?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, one of the best to get a team talking effectively with each other. Now let us look at the replay of last year's final race in San Francisco. So if we could just get that up on screen. Hamish, what are the common factors that will work season after season in San Francisco? For example, the current is strong. It's a big factor. It's very predictable there.
Yeah, and I think this is interesting because this final is going to be more in the summer, so more or less midsummer, whereas last final was in May and is kind of transitioning out of winter. So the sea temperature already is probably 16, 17, whereas I think it was more like 13. I don't know. It was a lot colder in May. And we're into the strongest sea breezes. You know, the best sea breezes occur in June, July, yeah. Because you have a good contrast in temperatures. And you have this upwelling, cold current, upwelling off the coast. So the water off outside the bay is really cold. And you have massive heating going on just inland. And and that creates a lower pressure during the day. So naturally, in the background, you've got the Northwest High, which sits on the Pacific in the summer, and you already have that high pressure existing most of the summer months. And then inland, you have a lower pressure already existing. So the contrast is there between the pressure offshore and the pressure inland. And then adding to that, for the sea breeze to develop really well, as the day heats up, the pressure lowers further inland, and you end up with this big difference in pressure. And that, so you already got a massive difference in pressure with a breeze coming down the coast from the north. And then it turns into the bay because it's the only place it can get inland through the Golden Gate Bridge, and then rips up into the bay and disperses itself inland. So that the temperatures typically in San Francisco City are dictated by the water temperature and very cold, typically, you know, under 20 degrees, whereas you can go inland a little ways and you're up to 35 degrees. And that brings the breeze in very, very consistently. So you'll see during the SailGP final that we're probably going to start with, you know, a little bit of fog in the morning, not unusual, burning off as the breeze comes in under the Golden Gate Bridge, and then building, you know, from sort of 2:30 direction, sort of building through the start time is 2 o'clock, 2:30, 2 o'clock, and continuing to build right through the afternoon and into the evening as the temperatures inland build. So it's not, wouldn't be surprising even this far out to predict that we're going to see 15 to 20 knots during race time. Fortunately, the current is also going the same way as the wind. It's coming in along the same shoreline, so that's going to make the sea state a lot more manageable, and that will be, you know, bring the conditions into, you know, out of survival and into manageable, but still going to be pretty full on.
Excellent analysis there. Thank you very much, Hamish. Just a few days away as we speak for season four finale, but let's look back at season three and let's look back at that deciding race.
So yeah, just to give a little bit of a following up on Hamish comments here, it's the earlier stage of the year, as Hamish pointed out, and we had the slight ebb tide on the shoreline, so we had this building chop, and the wind wasn't that strong as probably we'll see this year, But we still were in the HS booth, so in the small boards, which are very tricky to sail when you get downrange. So below 12 knots, below 13, 12, 13 knots, they get super tricky to sail. And here is where the teams with more experience and handling abilities make a difference. No, so here we are 1 minute 15 into the from the start of the race. As you see, the teams are coming into the box on port. They would have done practice starts and basically they figure out when they want to get into the box in order to be positioned in the place they want for the way back to the line. And you see, basically Ben is doing what he did all last season. So he's coming in late and he's going to try to tack below the other boats, hopefully getting into a tack and lock situation. And this is the way he did to try and win the pin, usually through the year, while Kiwis and Australians are waiting there to try and have more speed at the gun, or what we were talking before. The Australians here, basically they go for a roll on the Kiwis and they succeed into going for the transom of Ben and putting themselves in an ideal position. They got more speed and they got the favorite side of the line. So here there's very strong position for the Australians. And, you know, GBR got shoal in the back foot, while the Kiwis have surely the highest speed in this moment when they cut the line. And they're going to try to re-roll the Australians, which will have to do less, cover less distance now in this first reaching. So here, typically, you got trimmer streaming a wing a little bit flatter than the downwind leg, and you know here it's all a bit of a typical boat to boat situations. Australians are trying to create the way the space to better way in first position, and yeah, this is one critical point to get to the first jibe. You gotta drop the speed, drop the board at high speeds and control the boat in this getting closer to the shoreline. We had more chop, but this was a very critical moment, critical maneuver to execute well. All the teams are really good here, so we're going to see very solid execution.
There's also the wake of boats around. It's a busy racetrack. How much do they need to be concerned about that wake that the Aussies and the Kiwis crossed soon after rounding mark one?
Yeah, it's very critical. You're pushing these rudders to the limit. No, you really want to get the rudders elevators as close as possible to the water surface to reduce that drag. And by doing that, every little wake, waves and whatever could be a big issue. No, you could ventilate a rudder and that creates those pitch balls that the media really like, but the sailors don't. And as well, another important factor, and this is what Kiwi suffered here, is gas coming out of these wings is big, you know, like it's something you have to really consider when you're positioning the boat. And, you know, the Australians managed to jibe a little earlier and give a bit of dirty air to the Kiwis there, so they managed to stretch a little bit. And actually the GBR that jibed before find a clear lane came back quite well into the game. So the Kiwis from here, they have to sort something out, you know, and they decide to split, I think, at this gate, if I'm not wrong. So they're going to perform a jibe roundup and try to split from the rest of the fleet.
Do you think the British managed to get into second and the Kiwis dropped to third because the Kiwis were eating the bad gas of the leaders, Australia? Was that the fundamental factor?
I think a little bit, yes. And another part was the day was very shifty and gusty, and the Brits find a very nice line of pressure there and came down at high speeds. And you'll see the Kiwis basically from here on in this race getting closer and closer to the other boats. And this is given by a good strategical decisions, but also when you manage to offset yourself compared to the other boats, you usually tend to sail in less gas. And this is something you see in SailGP. You see that when the boats are together, they're usually a lot slower. And if somebody can get offset, they're going to get massive gains. So you see here, basically, this is what I was referring to before. They are a little bit downrange on these boats. So these boards, for the chop condition and whatever, we were getting at times 12 big louts, like 11, 12, 13 knots, which is not much for these boards. They're doing 55 to 60Ks upwind, which is still impressive, obviously. But the speed loss for attack, it's about 15Ks an hour. So and the minimum foiling speed for these boards, it's about 35. So if you enter at 55, you're going to perform a foiling tech typically. But if you enter below that, it's really easy to get into a touch and go. And when you get into that 35, 38, let's say less than 40 Ks an hour, you're going to put a lot of angle of attack on the boards, and that's going to produce a massive induced drag and going to make the acceleration phase a lot harder. You see that the Australians here, they got into the lull in the left corner of that course and they exit attack pretty slow. And that's a very hard build from here and requires a lot of work from the grinders. And you're going to set the wing in a different way and load the jib to get that boat flying again and accelerating fast. And you can really see the whole race, they are in that limit of basically having enough entry speed to perform a good foiler tech. So the Kiwis are doing a little bit better in this upwind and getting closer to the other two boats back. And you see basically with this entry speed of the Brits, they're just on the edge of doing a very, let's say, a good maneuver. From a tactical standpoint, basically the Australians are doing a textbook style. They're trying to stay between the Brits, which are in second here, and the Marks. And here they know that the Brits are not going to go, they're not in ley line for the left mark. So, you know, textbook, they're going to tech and take the right mark with both the other teams.
That's so the Australians have got the other two tucked away very nicely at this stage. And we saw the Brits do okay down this side of the course previous time round, but which do you think is the favoured side of the course? If all things are equal, which side of the course do you want in San Fran?
Well, as Hamish said, current is a big one, so it may change during the day. And it's not the current itself, it's a different current from side to side of the course. So typically here we had not much ebb the tide, so we had a little bit more ebb on the shore side, on the shoreline, while at the middle of the race course and on the right side of the race course we almost had no tide slack. So that was not a very current driven situation probably. And the wind was again very patchy and shifty, so you had to play a lot, watching, keeping your eyes open, more than picking a favorite side. Well, when you get that really consistent breeze in these conditions, probably the shoreline would have paid more dividends. No, and something we saw in this day and from this race is that top left corner was very dangerous. And the Australian got caught a little bit in this upwind, and they will get caught also on the last part of the race, which is, you know, it's famous in SailGP. You know, the Australians had to do we'll see it in a minute, a very hard maneuver there to stay ahead. So yeah, the Kiwis here did a great job through the upwind and this downwind to find the best breeze. And this boat is so efficient, so you just need a very little difference in the breeze and you're going to go a lot faster. And this is what happens here. The Kiwis are getting very, very close to the Australians again. And these are all the meters these teams are working for. Now every maneuver counts a little bit. Every straight line, the ability to push the boat as hard as possible. We spoke about getting those rudders close to the surface before. So this is really what's happening here. Like the Kiwis, as we saw, they putting their ability to gain points on the race course into good use here and getting real close to the Australians and putting pressure on them. And, you know, the Australians had a good lead before, so they had to do unforced errors and boats get closer and pressure higher. And I mean, it's as every sail race we've seen now.
And as your statistics showed earlier when we were talking about the Kiwis, they weren't the best starters this season, but they were by far the biggest gainers around the race course. Any three of you, Hamish or Simone, one thing that stands out about the way that the Kiwis sail their boat in season three, anything that you observed that's different?
For me? But actually, I think their technique is quite, let's say, impressive. I mean, straight line, they are the boats that are flying the highest in terms of ride height. And the problem that in CLGP with L foils is that if you are flying too high, you have a maximum amount of positive leeway. So you are basically going a bit sideways. So what they're doing is like being able to control this skid. Moving and let's say having the platform a bit rotated towards the wind, and obviously carrying trimming the sail, let's say with a closer angle, basically more in with the jib track and more in also with the clue of the main. So they are quite impressive being able to sail in this way. Obviously, it's very tricky if you have like a tricky venue, I would say, like Canada this year. That was really tricky, and they struggled a bit to sail the boat and keep sailing the boat in this way. So they went to let's say more normal way to sail the boat. But last season were quite impressive sailing this way.
And so I think from here, this is probably the key point of this race. Can we pause a second here? So just to add to Simone's list, I think one thing that is really, the Kiwis really have it, is they're really accurate. Mm-hmm. So they sail the boat, every maneuver is really repeatable and they're real accurate. And that's a style, you know, we raced against in the 49er against Peter Blair for years, and it was impressive how accurate they were all time, no? While Tom has a bit more an aggressive style and he's throwing the boat around the course very hard, and the crew is so experienced with these 50s that they're kind of recovering very well for every little mistake, or when basically they're in a mix, they're really able to fix things. And talking with Kyle Langford during first season, he told me like CLGP is a lot about recovery. Like, and this is what the Australians always had more than anybody else. And this, I think, the end of this race is really the example of it. So we'll play for it, and we'll see how they manage to recover through a couple of not perfect situations. No.
Well, it's looking easy for them at the moment. What could possibly go wrong?
Exactly, but it goes wrong real quick. So basically, here they decide to try and go for the ley line. So now they have to go around the mark one, so the white mark we'll see, and do a left turn to the finish line, and they try to go for the ley line. But actually they get a big transition in front of them, so the wind will go left in just a few seconds, and they have the shy on the ley, so they now have to do two closed techs plus the one they just did. So that's a difficult moment here, no? And while they have to do this, now they enter in a big lull, you know? And just in front of them, if you watch them board, there's a big line of pressure. So you see the speed drops quite a lot. They have to perform this stack where they get super slow. You see that hull is landing. 33 is not enough for foiling. They've got to get to 35 to start foiling again. And the Kiwis are doing 60, so 55. So they're going to do a better tech here for sure. The Australians need to go through a super hard build and tech again to the mark. And they enter this tech with not enough speed. And from here, they're basically trying to unload as much as possible the platform to get that foil working again and closing that door in, shutting the door in front of the Kiwis. And they just make it, and it's a matter of a meter probably. And this is really what it takes to win a season or lose a season. It really comes to that 1 meter that the Australians have been better in because of their recovery skills. So they had bad maneuvers there, and they managed to still keep that advantage from the Kiwis.
How do you do that? Yeah,
is a lot of coordination, a lot of crew coordination, a lot of communication. If you listen at the onboards of this thing, you're gonna have Kyle Langford calling the speed of the boat entering the maneuver. It's going to set up the wing in a completely different way. The grinder will start grinding harder, and also the guys in front that we the thing we don't usually see, you know, that jib trim from the grinder trimmer is really good. Like if you watch that case and analyze the data after it, I did it, I remember last season, you'll see that, you know, the typical things that we do in a sailing boat, but at those speeds and with that pressure, it's not always the easy. The jib Cunningham is coming off quite hard. The jib sheet is off as well. The car goes out, and basically they're trying to get after the first tech, that speed to pop again, accelerate enough to have enough speed to tech back. And then, you know, after the second tech, you can hear Tom talking to the strategist and saying, calm down, to really try and place the boat in a way that the Kiwis don't have a way around them. So that's all the sort of coordination that comes to play when the pressure is high and when you're playing for millions this year of dollars.
2 million, is it? How much do you think the skill sets have changed across the fleet since a year ago? How different is it for season four?
Well, I think as usually happens in these classes, no, like every season that goes on, the average technical level grows a lot. We got the Danish boat that possibly did the biggest step last year, and at the beginning of this season was doing really well.
Yes.
Then, you know, the French team is pretty much sailing at a high level as last year. They changed a few crew members, and they're performing very well lately. And then obviously, I mean, I'm here not because I'm here with Simone and Hamish, but the Spanish are the big surprise of this season. No, they got from finishing last year to now winning races and being real close to the final, to making it to the final race. So I mean, I'm quite impressed, and I think the technical level, the handling level, the, you know, the points gained on the course would be harder and harder going on with the seasons, because the teams are getting more solid, they're doing less mistakes, but recovering from mistakes is still a skill that is hard to build, and you really need experience and time on the boat, and this is what helped the Australians so much so far and gave them the possibility to win every season so far.
And this is the challenge for the newer teams, is how do you ever make up that lost ground on all the experience that the teams that have been in this game since season one? That must be the biggest question, and obviously something that all three of you guys have been trying to address. But let me also ask you, New Zealand, they've already qualified for the grand finale for San Francisco. So what are they allowed and what are they not allowed to do on the race course? Can they execute any kind of match racing on anyone they don't particularly want to be there in the final with them?
Well, I think there's there's no interest by by the Kiwis to do so, also because the rules are quite strict in if you get into any contact and whatever, and you know it's their race to lose, no? So they for sure they're gonna stay away from other boats, try to avoid to get into close calls, and see. I don't think. I mean, this is my guess. It's personal guess, not supported by any data. It's hard to have them, but I don't think they. It's convenient to try and match race someone in particular for them now. But yeah, it's a good point. They could. We saw the British going really aggressively against France last year in the first day of racing. So I think it's something to keep an eye open for.
And there's so much more I'd like to ask you, but we have pretty much hit our time. I just want to ask you about that start, and it looked to me like the Aussies and the Kiwis were going to just break the line and just be over, but it looks like they were absolutely bang on. Explain to me, how is it that teams are able to get that time and distance judgment so strong when they're coming so fast from so far out?
So you obviously, in this kind of racing, the thing is so fast and you don't have that much visibility with all these wings and carbon parts in the middle. So you have to rely on a software that is basically giving you a lot of information about the line and whatever. But the most important bit of information you're getting there is the time to kill to the line. So basically, this gives you how many seconds you have to burn in order to be spot on the line at gun. And if you listen to the onboard comms of the teams, you're going to typically hear one of the team members, like on the Australians is the wing trimmer, calling for time to kill continuously. So you're going to hear them shouting 5 to kill, 4 to kill, 3 to kill, 2 to kill, and give the helm like the information he needs to how much he has to slow the boat or get ripping to the start, and then typically you got a call like racing. No, like I'm talking about Australians. I know they, I listened to them yesterday, so I was reviewing for this. But this is basically the amount of coordination you need. There is watching at the software, providing the information from the software, and making your judgment as a helmsman to where to place the boat relative to the other boats, and then how to make the best trigger pull and get out of the line ripping. So as you see in the start before, the Kiwis didn't have the favorite end of the line, but they had the bows down, more bow down than the Australians had gun, and that gave them that little speed edge that almost gave them the opportunity to roll in that reaching. So it's super close. You have to rely on technology, as we said before, unfortunately. And then there's a lot of judgment on the boat-to-boat situations from the helmsman, a lot of instinct going on in that situations. No, Tom going for the transom of Ben and locking in before the start is, you know, is quick judgment. It's nothing like technological. It's instinct, judgment, eyeball, and go for it. No.
Yeah, amazing amounts of courage required in those moments. So we are on time. It's been a fantastic hour with you guys. Hamish, how excited are you about this weekend? You've got skin in the game.
Yeah, I'm really excited. Yeah, I can't wait for racing to start. It's even going to be at a reasonably respectable time, I think, for me, around 11 p.m., which isn't bad in Spain. it's going to be great. I can't wait.
And Simone, you're going to be there on the water witnessing it firsthand. How excited are you?
Yeah, very excited. I think it's going to be a very important event for us. We're going to have one day of training on Thursday that is has a huge importance in CLGP, because it's really rare to get like training days before the events, and to analyze the course and learn, let's say, also with luckily we are going to have the same tides as the weekend, So I think it's going to be a massive land there. And luckily, I mean, for me, I'm going to be in the coach booth, so it's not going to be too cold for me. I'm going to be behind the screen and helping the guys from the shore, from a sort of pit wall, Formula One pit wall, quite similar. And yeah, I mean, again, technology is a step up compared to last season that we all the coaches were on the rips.
And Jacopo, you've done fantastic analysis of season three on this last 60 minutes. I don't know what analysis you've done of season four, but what would the stats say? Who is likely to be joining New Zealand in that three boat final?
Well, I think we cannot.
I'm superstitious, so.
We'll close the book.
Likely we'll see the Australians. For what they did in last seasons, we'll see if this is going to be they've been a bit unfortunate. I mean, unlucky lately.
And then the Spanish. It's all right. I'll put the last one in.
I'm not going to say it.
We'll leave the last one as a question mark.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's going to be very nice to see and to see who comes on top and who gets to the final, and then really in the final who puts into good practice everything they've been working this season through and get the prize money.
Yeah,
great. Well, thank you to the guys who asked questions at the beginning. Great to see Matthias and Martin at the start of the call. And to you, Hamish, Simone, and Jacopo in particular, it's been a fantastic hour of analysis and insight into what makes these teams on SailGP tick. So thank you so much for joining us. Have a great week. Have a great weekend, Simone, in San Francisco. It's going to be another one to watch. The finale of season four. And we thank SailGP for giving us access to their data and to some of their footage as well. So all the best. Make sure that you tune in this weekend to the final of season four SailGP. See you there.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Have a good evening.